KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
It is clear in the Constitution that it is the Congress that has the authority to declare a war. It is the Commander-in-Chief who then moves to implement it.
After the U.S. strikes on Iran this weekend, lawmakers are set to debate a resolution on war powers. From Monday, June 23rd, this is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang with Ari Shapiro. President Trump said on social media that Israel and Iran have agreed to a ceasefire. This comes after a week of violence in the region, with Iran firing missiles at a U.S. base earlier today.
And I think the president really hit the reset button and said, look, let's actually produce long-term peace for the region.
Also, scientists are looking to sea lions for clues after a mass poisoning event off the coast of Southern California.
They're a really, really important sentinel species, and they can tell us all kinds of really, really interesting things about the health of our ocean.
Now News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. President Trump says on social media that Israel and Iran have agreed to a ceasefire, and he says that could end the conflict between them. NPR's Deepa Shivaram reports neither country, though, has confirmed the halt in hostilities.
Trump congratulated both Israel and Iran on having the, quote, stamina, courage, and intelligence to end the conflict, which began a little over a week ago when Israel struck Iran. The ceasefire deal came just hours after Iran attempted to strike a U.S. airbase in Qatar. U.S. defense officials say there were no deaths or injuries. That strike was in response to the U.S. hitting three nuclear targets in Iran over the weekend. But how successful it was in depleting Iran's nuclear capabilities is still unclear. Vice President J.D. Vance told Fox News after the announcement that Trump wants to work on a, quote, long-term settlement between the two countries. Deepa Shivaram, NPR News.
The Trump administration is rolling back a landmark conservation rule from the Clinton era that prevents road building on 58 million acres of federal forest and wildlands. NPR's Kirk Sigler reports the move comes as the Forest Service is under orders to increase logging.
The controversial so-called roadless rule effectively created de facto wilderness protections for scores of forests in the West and Alaska, and Republican administrations have taken aim at it for decades. Agriculture Secretary Brooke Rollins, who oversees the Forest Service, says she intends to rescind the rule, saying that would align with a recent executive order to remove red tape to boost logging on federal lands.
This misguided rule prohibits the Forest Service from thinning and cutting trees to prevent wildfires, and when fires start, the rule limits our firefighters' access to quickly put them out.
Environmentalists counter that wildfires are more likely to occur in forests that have been developed with roads and other infrastructure. Kirk Sigler, NPR News, Boise.
New York City holds primary elections tomorrow, and the Democratic contest for mayor is very hot. There are 11 candidates running for the nomination, including former New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, to succeed Mayor Eric Adams, who's also running for re-election, but as an independent. For member station WNYC, Bridget Bergen says a large number of voters have already cast their ballots.
We are seeing turnout rates that are more than double where they were at this point in early voting 4 years ago. You know, there is real attention being paid to the fact not only are the numbers coming out much higher than they were 4 years ago, but also based on our analysis of who is actually voting, the voters who are coming out are also younger.
Bridget Bergen reporting. Asian markets are trading higher at this hour. The Nikkei, the main market in Japan, is up 1%. U.S. futures contracts are also trading higher. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. An intense and dangerous heat wave is hitting the Midwest and the eastern third of the country, with the hottest temperatures of the year, including triple-digit temperatures that haven't been seen in some places in more than a decade. Heat records are falling more frequently because the planet is warming. The National Weather Service has issued extreme heat warnings and advisories for several areas, and many cities have opened cooling centers for those without access to air conditioning. And officials are warning people to limit their time outside, check on the elderly, take the pets inside, and drink plenty of water. The thrusters on a NASA mission to an unusual asteroid are working once again. As Joe Pelko reports, the repair should allow the probe to reach its target in 2029 as planned.
The mission is called Psyche, named for the asteroid it's heading for. In April, mission managers noticed that propellant flow to one of the spacecraft's four small thrusters had decreased. To diagnose the problem, they shut down the thrusters. The answer seemed to be a faulty valve in a propellant line, so they commanded the spacecraft to switch to a backup line. Now NASA says all four engines are working properly. Planetary scientists are interested in studying Psyche because of its composition. Most asteroids are made of rock, but Psyche is largely metal. A closer look may help scientists understand how planets with metal cores like Earth formed. For NPR News, I'm Joe Palca.
Crude oil futures are trading lower at this hour, down 4% at $65.76 a barrel. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation. For nearly a century, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society. More at Mott.org. And the listeners who support this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. Just this evening, President Trump posted on social media that Israel and Iran have agreed to a ceasefire that he said could end the conflict between them. This comes just hours after Iran launched missile strikes on a key U.S. base in Qatar in retaliation for the U.S. attack this weekend on Iranian nuclear sites. Democrats and even some Republicans have condemned the U.S. attack against Iran as unconstitutional. They have criticized President Trump for making the move without congressional authorization. One Republican senator supporting the case for the targeted strikes is Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska. She has a reputation for bucking her party and President Trump on other issues, and she's out now with a new memoir that talks about the place that she occupies in her party. Our co-host Juana Summers spoke with Murkowski this morning just before Iran's attack on the U.S. base in Qatar, and Murkowski said the next 48 to 72 hours will be crucial.
Senator Lisa Murkowski, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
I just want to start by asking you for your reaction to the strikes.
Well, I think President Trump made very clear that his desire was to negotiate with Iran, to move Iran from the capability of nuclear weapons. This is something that not is just a desire of President Trump. No one in the world wants Iran to have nuclear weapons, with perhaps the exception of Iran. And so the effort to move towards some form of negotiated settlement, I think, was important. I think that the administration, that President Trump realized at some point that Iran wasn't taking this seriously. And so he moved towards a very decisive action, very precise targets towards these three sites to take out Iran's nuclear capability. I think it remains to be seen the extent to which everything was destroyed, but with everything as fresh as it is from this weekend's news, I think we're all more than a little bit anxious about, all right, what comes next?
You have a background in law, as you write about in your memoir, and some of your colleagues on Capitol Hill have challenged the constitutionality of these strikes, making the case that they were carried out without congressional authorization for Congress. What do you say to them?
So the War Powers Act is specific in terms of the involvement of Congress if the president moves towards attacks, but it gives him, as commander-in-chief, the authority to implement targeted strikes in the event of emergency or event of threat. Our role in Congress under the War Powers Act is then within a limited time period, backtrack just a second here, that there would be notification to the Congress within 48 hours after any such attack. And then the Congress has a period of time, 60 days, to weigh in. I think it is clear in the Constitution that it is the Congress that has the authority to declare a war. It is the president, is the commander-in-chief, who then moves to implement it. We're going to have a debate on the floor of the Senate this week. Senator Tim Kaine has introduced a war powers resolution. Before we move on that, we're going to have an opportunity for an all-members briefing, a classified briefing to kind of detail more of the decision making process, and I think that will be instructive as we move forward in this next process as to a potential vote on the War Powers Act.
Vice President J.D. Vance says that this does not signify that the U.S. is at war with Iran or its citizens only war against its nuclear program, but how concerned are you that this move could put American citizens in danger, either in the region or perhaps even here at home?
Well, I think we're all concerned, right? This is about not only security for Americans, it is security for our friends in Israel, our friends and allies as well. And so when you have a directed, targeted attack like you have that hopefully has taken out the nuclear capabilities of a country that we have been pushing to say stop for all these years, you do have to worry about retaliation. What will this look like? How will it impact us and the threat that is out there? And I think it's been said by several already in the past many hours that these next 48, 72-hour period as we see how Iran will respond will be very, very telling. Should we be concerned? Yes. But I think it is important to put it in context. Iran has been threatening with their continued efforts towards their own nuclear capabilities for far too long. That in and of itself is that threat that should cause all of us to worry. But it really is, the president has said, it really is in Iran's hands as to what comes next. The path to negotiations is still very, very open.
And you can hear more of Juana's conversation with Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski about her new memoir, Far From Home, tomorrow on All Things Considered. Iran's retaliatory attack against a key U.S. military base in Qatar today was not a surprise. Iran is responding to the U.S. bombings of its nuclear energy facilities over the weekend, which President Trump called a, quote, spectacular military success. Now, whether or not there is a ceasefire between Israel and Iran, Iran could still threaten to close off the Strait of Hormuz. That's the narrow waterway connecting the Persian Gulf with the rest of the world. It's a vital pathway for world energy supplies. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf reports.
Around 20% of the world's oil and natural gas goes through the Strait of Hormuz.
A full closure would be a seismic event for energy markets and for the economy.
That's Clay Siegel. He's a senior fellow for energy security at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He says it could cause prices to surge, similar to what happened back in 2022 after the Russian invasion of Ukraine disrupted global oil markets, sending the price of crude oil per barrel skyrocketing to triple digits. On Sunday, Iran's parliament voted to close the strait, according to Iranian state TV. But the move would still require approval from Iran's top security council. In an interview on Fox, Secretary of State Marco Rubio said it would be a, quote, massive escalation.
If they do that, it'll be another terrible mistake. It's economic suicide for them if they do it.
It would absolutely be a very difficult economic outcome for Iran.
Colby Connolly is an energy analyst and senior fellow at the Middle East Institute. He points out that closing the strait would mean Iran would not be able to ship its own oil, too, which is why it seems unlikely Iran would actually go through with it.
I think that's why most of us that watch this space and the industry and the markets are thinking of this as an absolute worst case scenario.
Something Iran would only do as a last resort. Iran has never closed the Strait of Hormuz completely before, but it has attacked ships in the strait before, maybe most notably in the 1980s when the U.S. had to send warships to essentially escort oil tankers through and protect them from Iranian attacks. Clayton Siegel thinks something like that is more likely than a complete closure, covert actions against certain ships without totally halting trade.
It's not an all or nothing situation.
Israel has done significant damage to Iran's long-range missile capabilities, but Iran still has short and medium-range missiles, like what was used in the attack on the U.S. base today, as well as naval ships and underwater mines.
It would be a mistake to feel like they don't still have some significant arrows in the quiver to deploy against Gulf shipping. I think they do.
That would, of course, still have an effect on oil supply and markets, largely dependent on how long attacks went on and what kind of damage was done. The price of crude oil has fluctuated in recent days, and insurance for ships making the journey has gone up. But for now, it's all based on hypotheticals, until it isn't. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Washington.
Now for the story of a new college graduate who pushed through many roadblocks before collecting her diploma. Colorado Public Radio's Jenny Brundine reports.
I stand before you today not just as a graduate.
Caitlin McCormick, wearing black graduation robes, her hand shaking slightly, is talking to 1,000 of her classmates.
Honestly, there were days I was barely hanging on.
She's giving her college's commencement speech.
I was working full-time, raising a child on my own, and navigating a world that doesn't always see or hear people like me.
People like her. A deaf woman. McCormick was born with a genetic disorder that includes deafness. She has 2 cochlear implants now that help her hear and sometimes uses a sign language interpreter.
The truth is, this wasn't my first attempt at college.
When I went to the first college, I had no idea what I wanted to do.
She dropped out, tried a second and third time, but still wasn't able to finish.
I didn't have the finances or the support system to complete my college education.
At a call center job, she heard about a programming language. Then a trip to a thrift store changed everything.
I picked up a used programming language book at a thrift store, just hoping to get promoted. I didn't know it then, but that spark would light the fire that brought me here.
But it would be a while. McCormick became a single mom. At a new job, she learned about data engineering and knew it was time to go back to school. As a full-time working mom, she enrolled at the fully online Colorado State University Global.
I got overwhelmed, so I reached out to Kaylin, sorry.
She tears up. Kaylin is her best friend who has a disease that caused her to lose her hearing, the use of her legs, and her speech. She wasn't supposed to live past 19. She's now nearly 40 with multiple degrees.
And Kaylin, she sent me those messages. She would remind me.
Don't give up the rest of your life. My time is limited here, but you have the gift to not give up.
She says, you have the gift to not give up. That's what makes me cry every time I talk about it.
McCormick kept going and made it all the way to the podium.
Congratulations, class of 2025. We did it.
McCormick got her bachelor's degree in management information systems and business analytics.
It's a sense of fulfillment. It's a sense of achievement.
For NPR News, I'm Jenny Brundine.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thank you.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from BritBox, committed to shaking up people's watch list with British TV, including new original series like Ludwig, starring Peep Show's David Mitchell. Streaming now at BritBox.com/NPR. From Your Part-Time Controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting, yptc.com/NPR. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Elsa Chang, face to face with a snoring sea lion.
Sleepy princess.
This sleeping beauty is Arda. She's here at LA's Marine Mammal Care Center, recovering from poisoning caused by one of the longest toxic algal blooms that Southern California has ever seen. They've sedated Arda for her final medical exam before she can be released back into the ocean.
All right, so we'll come and do her ultrasound now.
Michelle Rivard is the director of animal health and conservation here.
So that's her kidney. All of this is intestinal tract. Everything looks normal.
So what do you think? Is Arda ready to go back into
the sea? Arda looks great. She's gained about 30 or 40 pounds since she's been here, and she has a nice thick blubber layer to give her a good head start before we send her back to the ocean.
I love it. She's all jiggly and happy.
She is. She's very jiggly.
Arda is one of the almost 400 sea lions and dolphins that the center took in this spring. They were poisoned by what's called domoic acid. That's the toxin produced by these algal blooms off the coast here. It can cause seizures and disorientation, and at least 1,500 animals were affected all across Southern California just this year. But now that the worst of the outbreak is over, scientists are releasing the last survivors.
I can also show you we have a bunch of samples in necropsy as well.
Oh, yeah. And they're gathering clues from the animals that didn't make it.
So we're headed into our necropsy lab. So necropsy is essentially post-mortem exam. So this room was very, very busy during the domoic acid bloom, unfortunately, because there were...
Look at this table with all the implements. This is where... The dead bodies would be.
This is where the dead bodies would be. So
there are towers of buckets in here filled with dolphin organs, sea lion fetuses.
So you can see a brain.
Very much a brain right there. Is that dolphin brain or
no? This
sea lion?
Is from a sea lion pup. So this was a pup that was born premature. Unfortunately, with domoic acid, we see a lot of sea lion moms not able to carry their pups to term. So that will be really interesting because we have animals at all different stages of gestation. So we're able to see fetuses at different types of their development and hopefully learn from them.
Wow. These samples can help scientists learn more about how the poisoning affected reproduction and whether wildfire runoff had an impact too.
California sea lions are really wonderful sentinels for ocean health. They're apex predators. They feed at the same level of the food chain that we do.
They're kind of like our front line.
They are, yeah. They're a really, really important sentinel species, and they can tell us all kinds of really, really interesting things about the health of our ocean and the health of our marine ecosystems, as well as human health.
And as that scientific detective work takes place, other scientists, like Justin Visbicki at NOAA, are already looking ahead to the next big event. He coordinates the network of facilities in California that respond to these domoic acid outbreaks.
Most of our facilities have done what they would do in a year in the first 3 months of this year. They've basically done all of what they would normally do in a very concentrated time period.
So what happens if next year you see another big outbreak? I mean, what would you do differently?
Well, the challenge is that we've got thousands of marine mammals off this coastline. And so, you know, I think the things that we would do differently is we would try to respond quicker and more timelier. If they're alive, how do we potentially get them to our facilities faster and in more numbers? Do we start moving animals up the coast and bringing them others up there? Do we bring partners from, you know, other places around California or all around the country to come out and help us?
In the meantime, Michelle Rivard says she recently got word that the Trump administration is dismantling a NOAA program, which monitors the long-term health of sea lion populations in California's Channel Islands. It's been running for decades, and Visbicki says its cancellation is going to leave big gaps for scientists.
We're not going to have a good read if we get into a situation where we're having a ton of sea lions dying from domoic acid. What does that mean population-wise? Well, hard to say what the population is doing if we don't have a good read on what the pup numbers are every year. And so both in short term and in long term, it's going to have some pretty big effects on stranding networks and science and really the understanding of California sea lions and their populations around the West Coast.
Meanwhile, on an empty beach in nearby Portuguese Bend, Michelle Rivard and her team are preparing to release one of her very last patients from this year's outbreak, a sea lion named Patchouli. She's in a crate loaded onto the back of a big truck.
Oh my goodness, yeah. The truck's bobbing up and down. She's feisty. She's ready to
go.
She's ready.
Yeah, she's excited. Yeah.
They roll the crate down a ramp onto the smooth rocks that meet the ocean waves. And then, open sesame.
Door is lifting. Here she goes. Oh, she's undulating down the rocks. Oh, she is just
she's making her way across the rocks and taking off.
Oh, are you kind of like sad that she didn't look over and say goodbye?
No, we'd rather have them not. We really like the releases where they're like, we're out of here, good riddance.
It's a happy ending for Patchouli, but for the scientists like Rivard, it's only the beginning of the next chapter.
After 104 days in detention, a federal judge ordered the government to release Columbia University graduate student Mahmoud Khalil. The Trump administration arrested him in March. They claimed his pro-Palestinian activism was anti-Semitic and threatened U.S. foreign policy goals. At the time, his wife was 8 months pregnant. She gave birth to their son without Khalil by her side. NPR's Leila Fadel talked with him about his experience.
Missing the birth of Dean, I believe that was the most tragic event that happened to me in my life. Mm-hmm. And last month, after so much pressure, they allowed me to hold him for an hour. So this time felt, of course, different. It's just very mixed feelings.
What do you mean mixed feelings?
I was in shock. Like, is this really happening? Am I daydreaming? But also mixed feelings about the hundreds of fathers in the detention center that there's absolutely no reason why they cannot hold their children. In some way, I felt that now I defeated Trump. They wanted to separate me from my family, but they failed.
Can you say more about that? I mean, this is an administration that has said very clearly that they think that the protests are bad, that they're anti-Semitic, and that they will continue to deport and detain students.
They want the protests to stop because it exposes this administration's and government's hypocrisy when it comes to human rights. In my case, they weaponized the immigration system to achieve what they want to, which is to chill speech. And Trump basically thinks that he creates the law and people should follow. So the fact that the federal judge ordered my release meant that Trump is basically no king.
That was Mahmoud Khalil talking with NPR's Leila Fadel. A Homeland Security spokesperson said Khalil's detention was legal and urged him to self-deport. The White House says it expects to be, quote, vindicated on appeal. The administration did not address NPR's questions on why Khalil was not allowed to speak to reporters, nor did they provide evidence for their claims that Khalil supported Hamas or incited anti-Semitism.
This is NPR News.
Carol Moseley Braun had served for years in public office by the time she was elected to the U.S. Senate, so she felt she'd earned it, even if other people didn't.
They just weren't accustomed to seeing somebody look like me in those environments, and it's like I had worked hard to get there.
Carol Moseley Braun on her new memoir, Trailblazer, plus the latest on the war between Israel and Iran, tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Bye.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Coming up, a massive underwater graveyard just south of Washington, D.C.
It contains more than 100 wooden ships dating back to World War I.
They just get filled with soil, and then the seeds blow in or the birds drop them, and they turn into islands.
That story after this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dwayne Brown. The U.S. Supreme Court is allowing, for now, the deportation of immigrants to countries other than their homelands. NPR's Sergio Martinez-Beltran reports the decision came in the form of an unsigned order, with the three liberal justices dissenting.
The order possesses a lower court order requiring non-citizens be provided an opportunity to appeal their deportations to a country other than their own. It is a win for the Trump administration, which has accused the men at the center of the case of being violent criminals undeserving of remaining in the U.S. The men were initially sent to South Sudan in May, but ended up in the East African country of Djibouti. That last stop to give them a chance to appeal their deportations. The Supreme Court's order means the government can immediately send them to South Sudan. In the dissent, Justice Sonia Sotomayor said the court's decision exposes, quote, thousands to the risk of torture or death. Sergio Martinez Beltran, NPR News.
On Wall Street today, stocks gained and oil prices fell even after Iran launched missiles against a U.S. airbase in Qatar. There were no injuries reported there. NPR's Rafael Nam has more.
It was not the reaction most investors had expected. Stocks gained instead of slumping even after the U.S. attacked nuclear facilities in Iran over the weekend. That's because investors are still hoping tensions will ease. Iran retaliated, but its attack against a U.S. base in Qatar produced no casualties. Meanwhile, oil prices actually slumped. Traders have mainly determined that oil prices have already gained enough since earlier this month, when Israel started attacking Iran. Of course, things could change in a heartbeat, and investors will remain cautious overall. But for now, financial markets are taking things in stride. Rafael Nam, NPR News.
The tech-heavy NASDAQ was up nearly 1%. This is NPR. Texas Governor Greg Abbott vetoed a bill to ban sales of virtually all hemp products containing THC, the psychoactive compound in cannabis, from Houston Public Media. Andrew Snyder says Abbott is now calling a special legislative session on regulation.
Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, the lead advocate for the ban, responded on social media by saying that Abbott had left the families who had seen their loved ones' lives destroyed by such products feeling abandoned. Abbott's veto leaves the state's multi-billion-dollar hemp industry intact for now. Patrick and others demanded the ban in large part because they alleged the industry was targeting minors. For NPR News, I'm Andrew Schneider in Houston.
The Oklahoma Thunder roared to victory last night, capturing the team's first NBA championship since moving from Seattle, they were the Sonics then, in 1979. OKC defeating the Indiana Pacers in Game 7. Pacers guard Tyrese Halliburton went down early with an Achilles injury. The Thunder will celebrate with a parade in Oklahoma tomorrow as other NBA teams try to catch up to the newly crowned champs in the offseason. Kevin Durant has been traded to Houston, and Cooper Flagg is expected to be the top NBA draft pick this week. He's going to be heading to Dallas. Stocks finished higher across the board on Wall Street today. The Dow gained 374 points. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the station And from Raymond James, a firm focused on transforming lives, businesses, and communities through tailored wealth management, banking, and capital market solutions. Disclosures at raymondjames.com. From Amazon Business, offering business buying services, from office supplies to IT essentials and maintenance tools to help bring visions to life. Learn more at amazonbusiness.com. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. Okay, there have been a lot of developments today in the conflict with Iran, a conflict that the U.S. got directly involved in over the weekend. First, Iran retaliated with strikes aimed at a U.S. airbase. Those strikes were telegraphed, and there were no casualties. And then this evening, President Trump said in a post on social media that Iran and Israel have agreed to a ceasefire. Senior White House correspondent Tamara Keith joins us now. Hi, Tam.
Hi.
Okay, so what can you tell us about the ceasefire?
Yeah, the first we're hearing is from a post on Truth Social from the president at 6 p.m. Eastern. He said that it would begin around midnight or Eastern time, or in other words, morning in the Middle East. He said that it would start in Iran, and then around noon Eastern, Israel would join it. And Trump said it will end what he's now calling the, quote, 12-day war. He's already naming the war in anticipation that this means it is over. We have not yet heard from Israel or Iran. Trump started his social media post with an all caps, congratulations to everyone. And certainly, if it holds, it would be a victory for his peace through strength mantra.
Indeed. Okay, do we know what led up to this ceasefire development today, if it indeed exists?
Yeah, Vice President Vance was on Fox News right after Trump posted the news. And he said that Trump has been working the phones and had been working on the announcement for a couple of hours. And he said Iran has basically indicated that it doesn't want to continue fighting.
What the Iranians have showed through their support of terror networks, through their now failed effort to build a nuclear weapon, is that they're just not very good at war. And I think the president really hit the reset button and said, look, let's actually produce long-term peace for the region.
Vance said that Trump hopes to encourage a long-term deal for peace between Israel and Iran. And as you said, earlier in the day, President Trump downplayed the significance of the Iranian retaliatory strikes, noting that the U.S. had gotten a heads up, which minimized damage. He called it weak. Symbolic may be a better word for it, since the Iranians filed at an airbase in Qatar, where President Trump had delivered remarks to troops just last month.
Okay, well, up until now, Tam, the White House has been saying that Iran's nuclear program essentially has been destroyed, right, after U.S. strikes over the weekend. What do we know about that? Is that true?
Yeah, outside observers say that is unlikely. Satellite imagery shows that U.S. missiles hit their targets with accuracy. But what is less clear is whether the nuclear materials there were there and whether they were destroyed. But President Trump is out there on social media again, criticizing those who've reported on the lack of clarity as fake news with zero credibility, trying to maintain the narrative of total obliteration, which is what he announced on Saturday. And one of the interesting parts of Vance's interview on Fox News was when Brett Baer pressed the vice president on whether the administration knows where Iran's stockpile of highly enriched uranium is located now.
Well, Brett, I think that's actually not the question before us. The question before us is, can Iran enrich the uranium to a weapons-grade level, and can they convert that fuel to a nuclear weapon?
Vance said that the U.S. strikes destroyed Iran's ability to enrich the fuel to the level needed to make a weapon.
Okay, well, what about this issue of regime change? Because the president has also mused on social media that perhaps the leadership of Iran should be replaced, and even at one point threatened the supreme leader. Is that threat still out there?
In the Fox News interview, Vice President J.D. Vance was asked whether there is a risk of mixed messages on this issue, and he sidestepped that as well.
Well, I think what the president is saying very clearly, Brett, is if the Iranian people want to do something about their own leadership, that's up to the Iranian people. What the American national security interest here is very simple. It's to destroy the nuclear program. That's what we've done.
And in terms of action speaking louder than messaging, mm-hmm. President Trump is now attempting to broker a peace with the existing regime. You know, a lot of his supporters didn't want the president to get the U.S. involved in Israel's conflict with Iran. And at this moment, it looks like he has found a way for this to be a one-and-done strike and not a wider war.
That is NPR's Tamara Keith. Thank you so much, Tam.
You're welcome.
Late tonight, Iran's foreign minister posted a tweet saying that there is no ceasefire deal as long as Israel continues firing against Iran. There was no word on the ceasefire deal from Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The Supreme Court has, for now, allowed the Trump administration to resume quickly deporting immigrants to countries other than the countries that they are from. It temporarily lifted a block by a federal judge in Boston who had said migrants needed to be allowed to challenge their expulsion to a so-called third country. We're joined now by NPR's Adrian Florido. Hi, Adrian.
Hi, Elsa.
Hi. Okay, so just catch us up real quick and give us the background on this case.
Well, earlier this year, the Trump administration was looking for ways to deport immigrants whose home countries would not take them back for whatever reason. And the Department of Homeland Security told its immigration agencies, including Immigration and Customs Enforcement, that it could send these migrants to some other country as long as that country assured the U.S. government that it would not torture or persecute these immigrants.
And how did immigrant rights groups respond to that?
Well, they sued, and a federal judge in Boston issued a temporary block saying that if the government was going to send someone to a third country, it had to first give them enough notice of where they were going and enough time to express fear that they could be tortured or face other harm once they got there. And if they expressed that fear, the judge said, the government had to give them a chance to make their case. The Trump administration appealed this ruling all the way up to the Supreme Court, though.
And what argument did the government make in this case?
Well, the Trump administration has said that many of those people it seeks to deport to third countries are violent criminals whose home countries, again, will not take them, and that it needs to find some place to send them. The Trump administration has tried at least a couple of times to get around that Boston judge's order. In May, it tried to deport some men to Libya, but it was stopped by the judge. Excuse me. And then a few weeks later, it tried to send another group to South Sudan, and those men never made it because before the plane arrived, the judge in Boston again intervened. Those men are being held now in Djibouti in East Africa, and they've been there in a sort of limbo ever since. But with today's Supreme Court ruling temporarily lifting the lower court judge's restrictions, the government will be allowed to finally send those men on to South Sudan if it wants to. Today's ruling was unsigned, and it gave no legal reasoning else, but the court's three liberal justices dissented.
I'm curious, what did those justices say in the dissent?
Well, Justice Sonia Sotomayor wrote it, and she was joined by Justices Elena Kagan and Ketanji Brown Jackson. Sotomayor wrote that, quote, in matters of life and death, it is best to proceed with caution, and that in this case, the government took the opposite approach. She wrote that in its rush to deport people to countries like South Sudan, the government was putting these migrants at risk of torture or other dangerous conditions. In the case of South Sudan, for example, it's a country in armed conflict, and the U.S. State Department has itself told Americans not to visit.
I'm curious, Adrian, if we could just step back, like, what do you think the big picture is in this case? Like, what is it really about, you think?
Well, like so many of the immigration cases that are being litigated in federal courts right now, this is a case about due process, Elsa, and, mm-hmm. and who's entitled to it. President Trump wants to be allowed to deport migrants as quickly as possible so he can deliver on his mass deportation goals. And in this case, that would mean expelling people to third countries without notice or hearings. Whether the Trump administration is going to ultimately be allowed to do that permanently is something that's still going to be argued in the courts. But for now, the Supreme Court seems to be okay with it.
That is NPR's Adrian Florido. And you are listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Hundreds of parties were held all around the world today as astronomers gathered to watch an event streamed live from Washington, D.C. It was the unveiling of some new pictures of our universe. The Vera C. Rubin Observatory was finally ready for prime time.
This is the first image that we are unveiling to the whole world today.
A screen next to the project leader, Jelko Ivasic, showed the black sky packed full of galaxies and stars. But then the picture zoomed out to reveal that the image was 50 times bigger, with about 10 million galaxies visible.
NPR science correspondent Nell Greenfield Boyce joins us now to talk about why giant pictures like this one will transform astronomy. Hi, Nell.
Hey there. How you doing?
Good. Okay, so my understanding is that this observatory has like the biggest digital camera in the world?
Indeed. It is the size of a car. It's a 3,200 megapixel camera. And so to display a full image, you really need like 400 ultra high definition TV screens. There is just so much detail. The human eye and mind can't really take it in. You have to kind of zoom in and out and kind of explore the image piece by piece.
That is so cool. Okay, so why is that something that astronomers wanted?
It's part of an effort to basically capture everything that changes in the sky over time. So instead of pointing a telescope at just one little cosmic object that you know you want to look at, the idea here is that you just take in everything. And that way you notice stuff happening that you otherwise never would have spotted. And so to do that, you've got this big camera attached to a big telescope. They're perched on a mountaintop in Chile. And the whole observatory is designed to point and shoot super fast. Wow. So that in a few days, it can cover the entire southern sky. And it has these automatic data systems that analyze the pictures and detect anything that changes and sends out alerts to astronomers.
Like what? Like what kinds of changes do scientists hope to see?
Basically anything that goes bump in the night. So anything that moves or changes in brightness, exploding stars, asteroids. They've already discovered over 2,000 new asteroids. They expect to discover millions more. They could see interstellar objects, stuff coming in from solar systems, maybe even another planet in our solar system, like way off in the distance.
Whoa. Okay. This telescope is named after Vera Rubin, obviously, who was an astronomer famous for her work on dark matter. Did I get that right?
That's right. Yeah. So this is the first major publicly funded U.S. astronomy facility to be named after a woman. And
woohoo!
It was built with money from the National Science Foundation, the Department of Energy. Lots of groups worked on it. It's been almost 30 years since it was first proposed by this scientist named Tony Tyson. I saw him at the unveiling and I asked him how he was feeling.
I feel amazed because we knew in principle that all of this data will contain that information, but actually seeing it visually blows your mind.
The scale of these images did seem to leave people a little dazed. There was a lot of quiet murmuring, but you know, it's going to get even bigger and bigger because it's basically going to watch the sky for 10 years, collecting so many images, you could basically make like a time-lapse movie.
That is so cool. And that is NPR science correspondent Nell Greenfield Boyce. Thank you so much, Nell.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
We'll be right back.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. The trial of Sean Combs is reaching a pivotal point this week. Federal prosecutors will finish laying out their case against the hip-hop mogul tomorrow. Then lawyers for Combs will take over. Their defense is expected to be brief, and it's possible that the jury could begin deliberating before the week is over. NPR's Isabella Gomez-Sarmiento has been in the courthouse since the trial started. She's here to explain the case prosecutors made against Combs and will warn you that this discussion over the next 4 minutes or so will mention violence and alleged sex trafficking. Hi, Isabella.
Hi, Ari.
The prosecution took more than 6 weeks, called over 24 witnesses. What was the big picture story they tried to tell?
So prosecutors are charging Combs with sex trafficking, transportation for prostitution, and racketeering conspiracy. Combs has pleaded not guilty to all of these charges. But basically what this means is the government is accusing Combs of running a criminal enterprise for 20 years that facilitated and concealed violence and sexual abuse.
The sex trafficking charges specifically span over a decade, and more than one witness accused him of trafficking. Can you explain what that charge actually means?
Yeah, so there were two women who spent multiple days on the witness stand. They gave very graphic and detailed testimony, some of which was very emotional. The first is the singer Cassie Ventura, an aspiring pop star who signed a Combs label and dated him starting in 2007. They were on and off until about 2018. The other alleged victim is not as public of a figure. She testified under the pseudonym Jane to protect her identity, and she dated Combs from 2021 until his arrest and indictment in September 2024. Both of these women said that early in their relationships with Combs, he asked them to have sex with male escorts while he watched and sometimes filmed. These encounters involved heavy drug use and lasted multiple days. Both women said they initially consented to these activities because they loved Combs, but as time went on, they told him they did not want to keep having sex with other men. Both Ventura and Jane said that Combs pushed them to continue, either through financial coercion, physical violence, and/or threats to leak those explicit videos.
Beyond those two accusers, who were some of the other key witnesses that testified?
So several former assistants of Combs took the witness stand. They said that they would buy drugs for him, they would set up hotel rooms with supplies for these nights, and they would often clean up after to avoid damage fees from the hotels. There are also escorts that testified that they were paid to have sex with Ventura while Combs watched. And there were a couple of hotel security employees who testified, including one who said that Combs paid him $100,000 to hand over video of Combs attacking Cassie Ventura. This sort of testimony is key to the government's racketeering charge that Combs employees amounted to an organized effort to commit and cover up the alleged crimes.
Well, apart from the witnesses, what were some of the key pieces of evidence that the jury saw?
A lot of it was videos and text messages. So earlier in the trial, prosecutors showed a video of Combs violently beating Cassie Ventura in a Los Angeles hotel in 2016. Ventura said this incident happened when she was trying to flee a sexual encounter with an escort. The jury has also seen explicit videos from these nights, but these have been admitted as sealed evidence, so the press and public have not been able to view what's in any of these videos. When it comes to texts, the prosecution has shown messages of both Ventura and Jane telling Combs that they didn't want to have sex with other men. But the defense has asked the witnesses to read texts that seem to indicate both women were voluntarily participating.
And just briefly, what do you expect from the defense when they take over starting tomorrow?
Well, we know it's going to be really brief. They said they're not going to call any witnesses, so it could be as short as a single afternoon. They say Combs was violent, but that he didn't traffic anyone, and these were consensual relationships between adults.
That is NPR's Isabella Gomez-Sarmiento. Thank you.
Thank you.
Time now for My Unsung Hero, our series from the team at the Hidden Brain podcast. My Unsung Hero tells the stories of people whose kindness left a lasting impression on someone else. And today's story comes from Eric Johnson. In January 2022, Eric Johnson's husband, Dennis Hopkins, was diagnosed with lung cancer. Their days of enjoying music, dancing, and gardening quickly turned into a life that was centered around cancer treatments. One day, Hopkins became too weak to sit up and was admitted to the hospital. The couple was told that he'd need another round of radiation, but even with the new treatment, he would only have a 50% chance of surviving. It was during this hospital stay that Eric remembers meeting their unsung hero, a nurse named Sherry.
She was something wonderful. like out of a movie, this sturdy woman in her blue scrubs with her pigtails. She turned to both of us and gave us the kindest, most no-nonsense roadmap for what actually did happen in the next 2 weeks. She looked at me and she said, "He's going to want to go before you're ready, but you just have to let him go." Then she looked at him and said, "When you're ready to go, it's going to be really hard on him. So you have to be really sensitive to him." Then she looked at both of us and said, "And everybody dies exactly the way they want to. If he goes when you're not in the room, it's because he couldn't bear to have you there. But if he goes when you are in the room, he wouldn't have it any other way." And you know, that's exactly what happened. The day that he left, I had to come and go from the room a number of times. Then one time when I came back in the room, I looked at him and I realized something different was happening. I hurried over to him. I put my hand on his chest and on the back of his head. I said, "I'm right here. I love you. I'll always love you. We'll always be together." And I just kept repeating that until he stopped breathing. If Sherry were standing in front of me today, first of all, I would hold her hands and look right into her eyes and say, "I can never thank you enough for what you made possible for Dennis and I to have his death go so perfectly. I wanted everybody in the world to hear what you taught us, because everybody in the world can learn a wonderful lesson from what you taught us that day. And thank you so very much."
Eric Johnson of Seattle, Washington. Eric and his husband, Dennis Hopkins, were together for nearly 30 years. You can find more stories of unsung heroes and learn how to submit your own at hiddenbrain.org.
Thank you for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Progressive Insurance, where drivers can compare direct rates using Progressive's rate comparison tool. Customers can see options and rates side by side. More at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. From Fisher Investments, Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.